makes sense. LinkedIn is saying, don't do LinkedIn. Okay, come on. Okay. Oh, we're live. Okay. Yeah, it's happening. Sorry, guys out there, whoever you are. This is David Rovix with another episode of Discussions with David, and which goes out in podcast form is This Week with David Rovix, if you look for it in any podcasting platform. And I am here with Jane Reynolds in Laurelhurst Park. Excuse the sounds of the traffic behind us, but it's very realistic that way. It's like the real world. We're in a park. There's a very large tent encampment nearby, and folks engaged in various mutual aid projects associated with that encampment. And those of you who are especially watching on my own platforms rather than on KABU or Popular Resistance might have run across Jane Reynolds in the form of Virtual Bird, which is her band, which is an amazing band from Olympia, Washington, and we have been collaborating on many different musical endeavors over the past couple of months, which some of you have been saying very nice things about. And she's a phenomenal musician, and I'll just let you look around on the internet and discover why I say that after you listen to this discussion, because I'm not going to try to like do the fancy techno stuff of like splicing in songs and all that. You know, I'm just you know, haven't gotten there yet. I should maybe, but anyway, there's your very, very simple, short introduction. But Jane, also, I happen to know, and people also who have been following the work we've been doing together, a lot of the stuff we've been writing together has been about people living and dying on the streets of this country, which is not only something that we both have written about in various forms, but is something that is... we're losing our phones. Okay, that's good. It's not... It's already cracked, so... But this is also a subject that unfortunately Jane is, fair to say, quite expert in. There's my one paragraph introduction. So everybody, this is Jane. And I can see your comments, by the way. We're broadcasting on various platforms if anybody has something to say.
Like, I don't think I'm an expert in anything, but I sure do know.
I think so. Expertise is, I guess, it's all in the eye of the beholder. But I would say you're very expert at all sorts of music and engineering and production, and you probably have a high degree of expertise in the in knowing what it's like to live on the streets of this country, having spent, unfortunately, I think 7 years of your life on living in some form of houselessness.
Yes.
Is that right?
So as a kid? I'd say about 10 years of discomfort, but 7 years of complete houselessness.
Yeah. That's an interesting way to put it. Yeah. Discomfort, because there's so many gray areas in there, huh?
Yeah.
I have to just, you know, put it out there that I'm a bit of a fanboy. I think you're just a phenomenal musician, and I don't understand how you got that good at the, you're only in your 20s, actually, right?
Yeah. I'm only 23.
Yeah. So I have no idea how that works. You know, like, you've done way too much in 23 years. But can we? I want to get into talking about your music. But I wonder how much is that related to your early years. Your parents were both musicians of one form or another.
So no, actually, my mom can sing very well, but she's never been like a musician per se. My stepfather, he was in a band or two back in the day in the 90s, punk bands. I think his band was called The Terrorists, back when you could get away with that kind of thing. But my family in general has been into music, like not so much in performing, but in singing around the family and like doing music events for the family, stuff like that.
But punk was actually something you were exposed to quite early on then?
Yes. My mom and my stepdad both listened to quite a lot of punk. And my first bands I listened to were mostly Neil Young and Jonathan Colton and a little bit of John Prine. But then my stepdad showed me bands like The Misfits or sadly G.G. Allin.
why sadly? Who's that?
G.G. Allin was a really terrible guy, but he was a punk musician as well. And he just, in general, bad man, but his music is fast and loud, so it can be classified as punk.
That, you know, that I this is a bit of a departure from the arc I was going for, the interview arc, the chronological interview arc I'm kind of going for, but that reminds me of something that you posted on Twitter recently, and I want to mention it because I'll forget otherwise. Do you think if the songwriter is you just find out the songwriter is a bad person, you no longer like their music anymore?
No, it really has to do if it's a personal thing for me specifically. I believe that in certain circumstance, you can listen to a musician, you can listen to their music and not feel obligated to, you know, change the channel per se. Like, I really like a lot of the Smiths, but we all know that Morrissey is a bit of a racist. It's if you personally can disconnect the music from the artist, like, that shouldn't be a problem, in my opinion. Some music like the Misfits, I love the Misfits, but Danzig, well, maybe not Danzig, but the rest of the band are pretty bad in their old ways. But yeah. So it just really depends, I'd say.
Yeah, that makes sense on whether there's a personal connection, especially to be, if it's something that if somebody wrote it a century ago, it's kind of like less personal. And then it's like you can kind of take it on its musical merits a little more, maybe.
Yeah.
Or just
if it's somebody I know personally, it's a lot harder in that way, too. Like I used to know the guy from Ghost Mice, won't say his name, but and he turned out to be a real scumbag. And that made me not want to listen to his music at all because I, you know, I knew the guy at one point or another.
I remember when I first heard Ghost Mice, it was at a place called the Junkyard, which no longer exists in Olympia. And whoever was listening to it in some old, like, beat up vehicle that was sort of barely functioning, I lived in a place in the junkyard, which the guy who owned it hated the fact that we all called it the junkyard. That's what it looked like, so we called it the junkyard. For in his mind, it wasn't a junkyard. But, I mean, we liked it, but it was a junkyard. And, the junk was kind of piled in. It wasn't so, like, there were paths you could walk on. It wasn't like a disaster area, but it was just like there was a lot of
useful
junk. Yeah. Yeah, people have extra cars because you need extra cars to keep one car running, right? It's the same principle. It's just, people in Olympia are less used to it than in some other towns. But I was perfectly comfortable, but we called it the junkyard, which for us was a mainly affectionate term, except, you know, for the mold. And, I mean, there was a tree that fell on my place and nearly destroyed the place. I mean, I was lucky to survive, but I can't remember why I was mentioning it. Oh, that was right. Somebody was playing Ghost Mice, and I was like, wow, this is fantastic. Who is that? It was definitely one of those experiences where I didn't know who it was, and I had to find out because it was so good.
It's really a shame he turned out to be such a bad guy, because I really enjoyed the John Heckley Jr. song. That was,
about the assassination.
Attempted assassination of Reagan.
Oh, that was Reagan. That was the guy. These assassins always have three names, you know. What's the deal with that? Their middle names are really important, apparently, you know, when it comes to assassins. I don't know. So where did you grow up in your early years, Jane?
I grew up in Franklin, Ohio. So deep in the Midwest. It was basically a glorified trailer park home, like one big trailer park that you called a town. Lots of opiate addiction within, like, different families all around the area. And there's a place called Little Hollywood, which is about as grimy as Hollywood is, but just small. It's a very low wages kind of area and very impoverished. It's also one of, like, Ohio in general has one of the biggest opioid crises in all of America. And that's pretty much why I became homeless, was because of a guardian, you know, not buying food and instead buying opioids and whatnot.
What part of Ohio is that in? Is that like near the Appalachian part or just
it's close to Cincinnati, Dayton, Middletown, that kind of Warren County.
Yeah, right on the sort of Kentucky border there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Ohio River.
So you've actually grown up with the opiate crisis has been a phenomenon since you were born, actually.
Yes.
And the music industry also, I mean, separate subject, but related in your case, in our cases too, your entire life, the music industry has been in a state of collapse.
Yes.
Right? Let's see, what year were you born now? You were born
1998.
You were born in 98. So the music industry actually began its descent into like shrinking. It began its shrinking the year before you were born is when it began. And then, you know, by the time you're 20 or 19, it had shrunk to 20% of the size that it was when you were born.
Yeah.
and during that time, the opiate crisis is raging across the country and the music industry is collapsing, you are living on the streets and becoming one of the best musicians I've ever heard at the age of 23.
Thank you.
Such a creative genius, I think.
I think it might have even spun from that. You know,
we were talking about that a little before. What do you think? Why? I mean, this is a terrible question to ask a musician, but I'm not trying to, you know, make a statement that automatically kind of ropes you into not being humble, but you're fucking amazing. And why did that happen? How did that happen? Were you playing music like at a really early age and people were saying like, oh my God, look at that. Or was it a gradual process or at what age?
Very
were
gradual.
You?
I'd say. I was introduced to playing guitar at 10 years old. So, and I kept doing it and kept doing it and kept learning. And I think that had a lot to do with why I'm like decent now is because like I had started at an early age and it just became a part of my body in a sense, like that musical feeling was pretty much always there for me, but I picked it up at 10 and then, you know, got introduced to all sorts of different genres and all sorts of different people and accumulated that musical talent over time. It's pretty gradual because I haven't started engineering until I was about 18 or 19.
Audio engineering, right?
Yeah.
And which you actually you actually went to school for? I don't want to skip ahead quite yet, but that's
okay. yeah.
But when you started playing. And at the same time as you're in the situation with the guardian who's addicted to opiates and you're in a housing precarious type of situation, was playing an instrument was like a therapy coping mechanism, all kinds of things.
I would say I actually wrote an album called Musical Therapy Sessions, which was essentially just me giving myself therapy via my musical ability. In any way, shape, or form, I could do that. So, at that time, it was pretty rough, you know. He would be passed out most of the time, so I would be just walking around on the street. And it seemed like every year, I was getting a little bit farther from home. Like walking every day until, you know, I got tired and would walk back home. It eventually, like... Wow. Got to the point where I was just sleeping outside, meeting strangers at a pretty young age. Thank God nothing bad happened to me at that age. But like I was walking around and begging for food from random strangers as like a 11, 12, 13 year old.
and that is what, as far as like being an 11, 12, 13 year old begging for food from strangers on the streets of a small Ohio city, right? I mean, that would that have been, I believe, a very unusual circumstance to be in, right? I mean, in other countries, children begging on the streets is very common. But here, here people begging on the streets is very common, far more common than in many countries. But they're generally adults, right?
Yeah. It is actually pretty uncommon.
and the people and you, but your experience with people at that time in the town was that they were generally adults were generally supportive or totally freaked out about your circumstances? Did they ask about what you were doing?
It's kind of a mix of mixed bag. It's mm-hmm. there were a lot of people that were really kind, a lot of people that were really gracious with what they had, and even though that town's not exactly wealthy, it's usually the unwealthy people that are the most generous, and that's why I probably survived as long as I did out there.
Isn't it true? As a busker, when I was playing street music in Boston, in the subways of Boston, for years, you could do it long enough, you can easily tell, just sort of what demographics are generous and what demographics aren't. To generalize, and the white guys in suits were the least generous and probably the most capable of being generous if they wanted to be. And the most generous demographic, at least at that stop where I played most of the time, were middle-aged Asian women who were overwhelmingly working-class women from the neighborhood, from Chinatown.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. Yeah. It's a sad thing, but
But that was would you say generally overwhelmingly the generosity came from the working class, not from people that lived in bigger houses.
Definitely. It still is that way. Yeah.
You never had some rich person come from some wealthy mansion in the suburbs and say, "Hey, why don't you live with us? We'll adopt you." Then it happens in the movie theater. Whenever like Punky Brewster or whatever, that was one of the. And when I was in the 80s, there was a sort of a show for teenagers about basically a sort of romanticizing a homeless girl who was like, they were trying to take advantage of the punk scene and like do something punk rock, and have a star that was wearing patches and had a piercing or something, but awful. It's awful.
That sounds pretty well. Punk in the suburbs. it's very strange. I actually, when I was very young, I started getting introduced to folk punk. So when I was about 14, I actually met Eric Peterson from Mischief Brew. And he was such a nice guy. And like he taught me how to play chords at some point. And I also got to meet Pat Schneewees, and that's an old friend of mine. And both of them, Pat Schneewees was Pat the Bunny or Ramshackle Glory or, Winged Up Dishwashers Union, Johnny Hobo, that stuff.
That's all the same person?
Yeah, it's all the same guy.
And okay, so somebody was just talking about Pat the Bunny the other day and saying that the last anybody heard about Pat the Bunny was a posting on Facebook that was kept up for 2 minutes and then deleted, and then nobody's heard from Pat the Bunny ever since. Is that your understanding?
Well, no. So, his close contact friends and family do talk to him, and I suppose I'm somewhat in that circle. I talked to his brother Michael a little bit there and there, and the label Fig 4 Inc. is run by my friend Chesky, and Chesky actually is good friends with Pat. So,
Chesky's
I know
amazing.
Where
you showed me.
Chesky is an incredible musician, one of my favorite musicians. But
so I guess maybe any rumors that are out there that something terrible happened to Pat the Bunny, he's still out there and
no, he's fine. Okay, yeah, he's just a Buddhist. He does IT work. He's a normal guy. Everybody wants him to come back, but I don't think that's good for him. So.
Yeah, good.
He quit doing drugs and stuff, so it's good to see him nice and sober and like living a healthy life and being a good guy. That's really all I could ask for that circumstance. Yeah. But yeah, no, he's fine. He's not in any kind of bad situation.
And Eric Peterson. What a fantastic songwriter, what a fantastic band, what a terrible outcome. I guess I was on one of his last gigs together when we played we both played at the 100th centennial of the execution of Joe Hill in Salt Lake City, and then a few months after that he was dead.
But dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night alive inside. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the last time I saw Eric was in 2015, I think. It was at a small taco slash venue bar called Tacocracy or Taco Crazy. And at that show is actually, Eric gave me a guitar from the back area because my guitar had been broken by a drunk guy. So I walk in there and, you know, I start talking to Eric. I'm like, how has it been, ETC? And I was telling the story of the guitar, not purposely trying to get a guitar from him, mind you. I was just telling the story about earlier that day. And then Eric basically says, hold on a second, walks back into the backstage area, grabs a guitar. It's a Fender guitar from I don't even know when. And he brings it back up to me and hands it to me. And I still have that guitar, still the one that I use today. And he was the kind of guy that made you feel like you were the center of the universe every time you talked to him. A very sweet man. And it is a shame that he is no longer with us. I'm still relatively friends with his wife, Denise. She's a sweetheart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is such a high suicide rate among musicians and poets and artists in this world, and it's the subject of a lot of stupid jokes and a lot of documentaries and a lot of like, oh, look at this genius who killed himself, as if that never happens to so many other geniuses, you know. But it's like it's actually a really widespread phenomenon, and I guess there was a poet who used to come to an open mic I ran in Massachusetts like 25 years ago, and he would talk about it like regularly, you know, because it was kind of his thing, you know, and he was a really good poet, but he was his thing was other poets, you know, and his concern for their mental health and well-being. And I wonder thoughts you have on that subject.
I am fans of a lot of musicians who have passed away in that way. And, like, for instance, Sparkle Horse, or, let's see, there are a few, Adrian Borland from The Sound. Adrian Borland, actually, he jumped in front of a train when he was younger. And it's a sad story because he was, he's one of the main musicians I look up to in the goth part of my music, and he was schizophrenic, as am I. So it was a shame to have read about that and learned about that. And my opinion is that, like, it would be better if none of them had done that. You know, none of them had died. Of course, I don't like the glorifying of musicians who do that. It's a shame. It's a shame whenever it happens.
What do you think are the biggest factors, that in your just experience with musicians who have either taken their lives or thought about it or just suffered from depression, which I think is also disproportionately something that affects musicians? And I don't know that statistically, but I'd be willing to bet that that's true. Yeah. And I think actually that it's playing music is a coping mechanism for people who are suffering from all kinds of different maladies of different of one form or another. I mean, music is just great therapy. So it's
I bet on that too. Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's probably one of the main things, right? But yeah, I mean, but then how much of it is also about the, I guess there's so many other potential factors, like, but I guess all this long predates the collapse of the music industry. So it's not, we can't necessarily blame it all on that, but there's so many, and then the phenomenon of becoming famous at a young age, and which is, I mean, I guess you've never suffered from that particular problem.
Yeah. Right?
But a little bit. Can you talk about that? What was that like? And what happened there?
So I did an interview back in the day. It's like where a lot of people know me from, actually, is that.
I love hearing a 23-year-old say back in the day. Sorry. Continue.
There was a video of my life story in documentary form. I don't particularly enjoy the way it was edited. It was since taken down, but it was a VR chat video. And that video got 2 million views. and it didn't even have my name on it, which was just yeah.
Oh, that's just so frustrating. Gosh.
If people see me, they'll probably call me Kevin Costner, which is not my name, never has been my name, but it's the name of my avatar in that video game. Pretty goofy. Kevin Costner, the Dances with Wolves guy.
Yeah, right. Which then means, like, even if you put something about, like, trying to make that clear, like, on your YouTube channel that you're the guy they called Kevin Costner, that's going to accomplish exactly nothing in terms of anybody clarifying the situation, right? Because anybody searching for Kevin Costner or whatever, they're not going to think about you. They're going to think about Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
indeed.
Yeah.
It just felt like a bit of a character the way that it was presented. I didn't enjoy that much. I prefer to be known as me, you know.
Yeah. Although at the same time, thinking about that, I mean, I haven't seen it, right? But the documentary that this person made was basically focusing on the fact that you were in this difficult situation, precarious housing situation, and that you were a brilliant musician. Was that the basic focus? Or?
Yeah, I would say so.
Mm-hmm.
It's very spread thinly, I would say. But I suppose it worked for a lot of people to be like, oh man, homelessness is sad. I'm like, yeah, I guess that's something you can take away. But it's a little bit more important than just a sad story.
Yeah.
Right? Like the structural ways that a person can become homeless and stay homeless is just insane. Like, if it weren't for just lucky situations, I would still probably be homeless. You know,
lucky situations, which is somebody was saying on somewhere I was listening to recently, like the what they used to call the safety net. It's more like actually walking a tightrope, and increasingly, it's like a tightrope made of fishing wire, which is quite an image. But yeah, you fell off the tightrope. You know, it's much more accurate than you fell through the cracks of the safety net or whatever. You fell off the tightrope.
I never had much of a safety net, so.
No, but you've been on that tightrope a whole bunch of times.
Yes. The eggshells, etc., of being mentally ill and trying to maintain a living situation. Very difficult, unless you have people around you who are also mentally ill who can sustain themselves properly. I just happened to land in that kind of situation with some really beautiful people that I live with. And
see, you guys were looking out for each other, basically, was the thing.
Exactly. Give each other solace and that good stuff.
One of the things that I've been just realizing so much, sort of working with folks out here on the streets, is it's just how much of an issue mental health and just like, you know, and drugs and alcohol is in terms of just being able to function in even if you have a place to live that you can afford, being able to stay in that place and function as a acceptable, you know, sufficiently normative member of society that you don't get evicted for whatever, you know. I mean, you hear stories that are very common, at least in Europe, about Roma people liking to make fires in their homes, and then the people that think you know that the kids can't bear the idea that Romas should be given a fireplace, you know that this sort of thing. Like, I mean, how about trying to adapt, you know, cultures that, you know, whatever. Like, there's just here it's just. But I wonder, that's something that you must have become pretty intimately familiar with in your life.
Yeah. So for a long time, I had a really bad issue with drinking, and for a short time, I had a big issue with taking drugs, like hard drugs. And that was a lot of the reason why I couldn't get out of it until I quit cold turkey. I was addicted to heroin for a long time. And then I quit cold turkey one day, and I have been clean for, I think, 3 or 4 years now. Could be less, could be more. I don't remember.
Right.
Timelines get a bit mixy. But
what would you say that what is for a habituated heroin user, what would you say is the pros and cons in terms of making music on heroin?
I would say that it was worse when I was making music on heroin.
Just generally overall worse.
Yeah, Yeah, it just sounded worse.
you can the lyrics still do it. Stupid. Would people recognize it as? Oh, when you were making. But what if you're trying to perform on heroin? What was
oh.
that like?
Oh God, yeah, no, it's terrible. It's like I'm fucking half dozing off, and by perform, back then I was performing on the street mainly, like mostly, and that was a mess. You know, I got whiskey bottles next to me. I got my tin foil and all that garbage next to me, trying to perform a song at like times two half speed, essentially.
Times two half speed, like sort of like speeding it up and then having a train wreck at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was a mess.
Getting arrested for, I mean, it's, I'm busking on the street with the evidence of heroin use right next to you. I imagine it ends you up in jail.
Yeah, and also the idea of like not caring about your body and not caring about yourself in general comes with that kind of usage after a while. And then what you're doing is like not caring about how your music sounds, not caring about how people perceive you on the street, not caring about how law enforcement would perceive you, like being totally cool with just going to jail and like living in jail. But like that's not nowadays. I'm just like f that. I don't want to be perceived as that anymore. You know, like I don't want to. I care about myself now, which is another thing that was great about becoming clean and getting off the street. You know, I started caring about myself more, and it's such a shame that like. Most people that are homeless don't have access to that kind of like escape. And I was just lucky enough and hit certain circumstances to where I could start to learn how to love myself and learn how to care about myself and my well-being.
And of course, it's easier to love yourself and care about yourself when you have somewhere to live and you can afford to have a place to
shower.
Live and shower. Yeah. And have, yeah. And then when I think about just specifically the situation of a musician living on the streets, and I think about, you know, when I was young and the number of musicians who are out there who were in oftentimes, you know, relatively precarious circumstances, traveling and living in maybe some kind of, you know, maybe living out of a vehicle or even living on the streets. But then generally, if you were in a situation of any kind where you could make a physical recording, which, you know, I guess depending, you know, if you were really bad off, maybe you wouldn't be able to get that together. But like generally,
there
if you could
few.
Make some kind of recording, then you could just like if and you good did good music, then you could just sell them while you played, which is of course a phenomenon of the past. And I realize that I'm not saying this is a solution for now. I'm just saying like for your view of your own self and your own self-worth must be so impacted when you're basically can't in any kind of really straightforward way make money from your work by like, you know, the old very, very sort of easy to understand transactional, you know, thing of like, you make good music, you recorded an album, I am going to pay $10 and buy it. That's the transaction.
Indeed.
You sell 10 or 20 of those in a night.
To not exist as much anymore. Yeah.
No, it doesn't. No.
And so
being able to pay rent doesn't exist so much anymore either, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, and that's like, I just want to, just for the people out there, you know, who don't realize this, Jane, you have, I don't know, 5 or 6 times as many followers as me on YouTube. And you, you know, and people who are, you know, watch my shows or know me, they know that I'm basically surviving as a musician more or less, you know, and I complain about the rent, of course, a lot, but you know, they know I'm kind of making making a living at this. And yeah,
weirdly enough, you have about twice as much listeners monthly on Spotify, but on your podcasting side, or like, you know, what you put on YouTube and stuff, you have less than I do on YouTube and all that. It's so weird how the streaming stuff works, because like I probably get paid, I think like $100 or maybe $200 a month from all streaming services combined, which is just, and it's annoying, because you put in an amount of effort into a thing, you expect to get something in return. Not the case with being a musician these days. It just doesn't work out the same.
No, nope. And that's just things. And $100 to $200 a month from streaming, all streaming platforms combined, just you know, to be perfectly transparent, that's exactly what I'm making too. And I you know, somewhere, and it varies wildly with each month, doesn't it? Does it for you too? Isn't that strange? Like some months it'll be $100, the next month it'll be $200, right? And you never know.
Exactly. It seems like, so when I was homeless, I had no hope for my music ever making any money. And I had no hope for ever getting to collaborate with some of my favorite musicians, which includes you, definitely a favorite of mine. And also, like, more recently, I've started doing a project that includes XYU, or Shushu, which is one of my favorite post-punk bands. I got Jamie Stewart to do vocals on that album. And I never could have dreamed to have made those connections when I was, you know, dope sick and homeless. So it's now I have so much hope for the future. I have so much hope for my musical ability and career. I did not have as much or any when I was homeless, which, you know, is the truth of the matter, is the reality about what people must feel when they're homeless and a musician.
Yeah, generally, right? And so speaking of career aspirations, and I just noticed that somebody has been commenting on YouTube who is, first of all, Mustard Toast, who is somewhere in Europe and is a big fan, apparently, of both of our music. So you know you have fans in Europe, but there's one commenting on YouTube, and you need to go play in Europe. So we're going to be working on that. Oh, your first tour of Europe has to happen. But Mustard Toast says that Pat played a show with Cheshi in 2019, and so that's one of and somebody on Facebook is asking Eric who. Eric Peterson from the band Mischief Brew. That's the Eric we were talking about. And
I remember Pat did this almost spoken word thing with Jesky more recently, on the 2019 album. I think the album got released in 2019 late or 2020 early. Can't really remember, but it was a really good album. I recommend listening to all of Chesky's stuff, because I think that every song he's ever made is just brilliant.
He's amazing.
And this newer album, I think, is going to be on a Fake Four's label, their Bandcamp label, and they might help me out with like merchandise sales and stuff too, which is really interesting. You know, I actually had drinks here in Portland with Chesky more recently, and he is such a sweetheart. He's such a kind man, and I've known him for a while, but it would be such an honor to work with Jesky on stuff. And it seems like he wants to at some point. So there's another hopeful future task of mine.
And this is like, and then, you know, when, of course, just to, I don't know, just to kind of like, from a non-musician standpoint, I could just imagine that, like, you know, people might be watching this thinking like, okay, here are these people talking about how there's no music, how there's no money in this business and how hard it is. And all they're talking about is how much they wish they could record with so-and-so, you know, like all I want to do is just make music. Right. And that's what people have been doing with their stimulus checks too. It's like that's what I've been doing too.
Yeah. Right. Same. It's because, like, even though it doesn't exactly pay the bills, it's what we want to do. And the reason why that's so important is because this rent, you know, capitalism, these things prevent us from doing this more often and better of our ability. Like, I could have probably played with all of my favorite musicians if, like, I wasn't so worried about surviving the next day already. You know, like, that's such a huge point, like, reasonably so. Like, it's music might not pay the bills, but the bills should pay for music, you know, because music is something everyone needs. And yeah, I don't know.
Jesus.
A little bit of technical.
There you go. Technical issues. Okay, I'm back. Okay, I keep on trying to avoid echoes by muting myself, but then I can't see my screen, so I'll just stop doing that. But But Jane, when did you talk about getting into doing engineering? Because this is something, and first of all, for, you know, we're talking music, we're talking shop here, but this, it's okay, you know, this is my show. And people out there who aren't musicians, though, like, you know, I mean, doing music and recording albums, even forget about touring, but just like making albums or making music, there's so many different roles involved with that process. And like it, from playing different instruments to being the one who's, you know, sort of recording everything, the engineer, and getting different effects, which all that stuff, which the engineer is doing, and being the producer who's like figuring out how everything goes together. These are all these different roles. And normally for a lot of people, I mean, there is a lot, you know, there's people who do all these things, but a lot of people are very much specialized in one thing or another. There's a lot of touring musicians who barely can function in a studio. A lot of studio musicians who have no idea what to do with a soundboard, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these things are specialized, and a lot of producers who are great producers, but who, you know, don't even play an instrument well. And I mean, you could do all these things really well. And how did you get into engineering? That was something you decided you wanted to go to school for? And was that useful, going to school for it?
So weirdly enough, I went to school for digital design at Warren County Career Center in Lebanon, Ohio. And I went to school to learn how to do film design and Photoshop and do that kind of stuff. And we just so happened to not only have a music studio built into our classroom, wasn't even taught. Like, music was not an important part of the class, but my teacher was really into folk music. And so he taught me to do that instead of doing the other projects, because he saw potential in me on the music side of things. So how that worked out was he gave me all the credits for everything else I was supposed to be doing, and just had me focus on the production of audio. And that audio lab was specifically meant for filming purposes, for getting sounds for film. And what actually I used it for was, you know, making music. And he taught me how to use GarageBand and Ableton, and like really like fleshed out my abilities. And at a very early age, you know, like I think 17 or 18 is when I went into that school. And so, like, I was supposed to be doing an entirely different thing, but then ended up doing that. And like got a, what is the associate's degree in audio engineering, essentially, and digital design. It's like the blanket term.
And have you done a lot of audio engineering for other artists as well since then?
So, you know, I can't really remember the last time I've done it, but I have certainly done that before. I believe I have done audio engineering for a smaller folk punk band that just kind of ran up on me in San Diego and asked me to do some stuff with them. And I also did some audio engineering from a few of my friends, but nothing I don't think anybody would recognize. But so I would like to do that, but I'm doing that with you right now. Yeah.
Well, that's true. Great job with that. And Mustard Toast says you should come to Lisbon. So there's one invitation, apparently. But
where is Lisbon?
Mustard Toast needs to organize a gig there. That's the capital of Portugal. And
Portugal.
There's a great festival there. I played at one time, but I don't get to Lisbon much. But it's there's a lot of good. A lot of good gigs to do in Europe. They have 100 times as much sponsorship for the arts on average in Europe than they do here. So
it's just that seems like a better tour than touring America.
100 times you start to notice, you know, it starts becoming noticeable, you know. Here in the United States, the arts are supported as much the army bands in the army band, the army bands have a bigger budget than all of the other arts combined in this country. So yeah, it's not like that in Europe. And like, you play in a punk club in Denmark and you're going to get paid by the culture ministry, who knows you're a punk band playing in a punk club.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. I dig that. Yeah, as long as I don't have to play in Russia, you know.
In the right circumstances, maybe, but it sounds like it can be a very scary place to be.
certain, I'd say specifically folks. For like trans people,
yeah, it'd
be pretty difficult to be in Russia and be who I am, which
How difficult is it to be trans in this country? I guess you wouldn't know what in comparison to Russia, but I mean, like, you know, people can't see this, but right now I'm wearing a kilt, and the number of microaggressions I get just walking down the streets of this city in a kilt is amazing. And I mean, nothing overt, but it's amazing. Just that. I mean, and if that's happening, I can't imagine. It must be going on for so many other people for in a much bigger way.
In this country, it sucks. It's pretty rough. I've been to gay bars where, you know, you think it's a place of inclusivity, but it's definitely not. And I would be like wearing a dress or of some sort. And, you know, a gay dude would come up. It doesn't really matter that he's gay, but some random guy would come up and try to lift my dress, or like people would try to like get in my business, and I'd just have to fight them and get them.
Such a disappointment that would be happening in a place like that, where people you'd hope would be understanding.
My recommendation is to go to goth clubs. There is a goth club event kind of cycle in San Diego called what is that called? I can't remember. Oh yeah, Sabbat. Yeah, there's a event every month called Sabbat where all the goth weirdos come out of the woodwork and go in all their makeup and their dresses. And it doesn't matter if you're queer or if you know, you're black or like anything. You're totally allowed inside, and you just get to dance with your friends to goth music. Sometimes live bands that are goth. I saw a couple really great bands. I saw Pink Turns Blue, actually, at Sabbat, and that was a wonderful experience. And I never got judged from anybody, never any racism or homophobia or transphobia in any kind of goth place. It seems like they're more accepting, even more so than punks are a lot of the time, which is
very interesting. So that would be, you'd say, in terms of like the scenes you've encountered, the goth scene is the most inclusive, ecumenical kind of scene in terms of just being welcoming.
Absolutely.
What? But I guess you have to go. What if you're not looking very goth? Then it's still okay.
Usually fine. I recommend wearing at least a little bit of black.
Right.
Listening to a couple goth bands. There's some pretty good stuff.
There is, right? But and did you get into the goth scene before you got into goth music, or the other way around?
Other way around. I listened to some Bauhaus when I was younger, and I loved The Cure. I think The Cure makes some pretty wonderful music. I can't imagine the kind of microaggressions Robert Smith used to face in the 80s. You know, I can imagine 80s and 90s. That was pretty rough on him, just for putting makeup on and wearing frilly stuff.
Yeah.
But he just kind of pushed through it and didn't give a shit about that. So pretty nice.
Yeah, when people can manage that, huh? Indeed. And so can we talk about, you were talking about having future aspirations as a musician, and I wondered what kind of things you're thinking about in terms of near future or distant future, or any, you got a 5-year plan or anything?
My hopes for what I'm doing is to finish this album I'm working on right now. This is actually really cool, this album. So far, the help I'm receiving with it is amazing. I've gotten help from David here, and I've gotten help from Shushu, of course. But I also, the album is partly inspired by Silent Hill 2, which is a horror video game from the 90s. And the game is basically centered around this guy experiencing this misty town that has monsters in it, but the monsters are representative of his sins and his life. So it's almost like a personal hell for James, the character in Silent Hill. The monsters all representative of his bad sex acts or his treatment towards women in his life. And my idea for this album is basically taking both the audio engineering of Silent Hill 2, like the way that it sounds, the way that it feels, and making my own version of basically a Silent Hill, it's a kind of like a Silent Hill musical that is about my dysphoria as a trans person, or the things that I am put up against as mm-hmm. being a trans person, and almost making a horror album where the monsters are just my dysphoria or the judgment that I get for being trans.
God, and that's amazing.
I talked to the creator of the creature designs, the monster designs of Silent Hill 2, Matsuhiro Ito, on the telephone about that as well. I got the chance to, I reached out to him on Twitter. He was very strange on Twitter, and then he shot me a number. I called him, and then we chatted about stuff. And basically, all he told me was, everything needs to come from the bottom of your heart. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I can understand that. It's like, if I were basing something loosely off of you, I wouldn't call you up. And I'm like, that makes sense. He's just like, yeah, just from the bottom of your heart. And
so he was just very supportive of the idea?
He was supportive. A little ambiguous, but supportive nonetheless. He's a sweet man. Yeah. Right. Makes a lot of really funny Twitter posts, so I like to follow him and see his cool art. But I have a queer engineer and producer working with me on it. Somebody who has a lot more studio expertise than I do, who can accurately depict those things with synth boards and
the sounds you're trying to get.
Yes.
Great. And where's the engineer located?
I think they're located in Canada.
You're not even sure, right? That doesn't really matter. Yeah. It's all.
I know they're in Canada, but I'm not very certain of the town. I know they've worked in the same studio as Godspeed You Black Emperor, which was a ambient band that made some of my favorite stuff, like some of my favorite ambient albums that exist. And they're also on the anarchist side. That band, and it's just really cool to be working with somebody that has that kind of expertise.
Yeah, and do you have any particular hopes in terms of touring and that sort of thing? I'm just curious what's it like being a young musician.
I only covered the newest thing. So my hopes for touring is I hope to tour the United States next year. At least a little bit of it, you know, just like what I can cover with the amount of people that I have that listen to me. Hopefully, you know, I get some good showmanship in Ohio at least, and get to travel around, see my family a little bit, and play some music in a couple different states. And then another thing is I would love to collaborate with the band AJJ, because I get a lot of people that want me to do that, but it's kind of, you know, a little bit harder than just wanting to. So I don't know. I think that it would be possible to do that after COVID is wiped out. And if I just chat with Sean from that band a little bit, that'd be really that's kind of one of the big hopes, you know, being able to tour with them or maybe just collaborate on something. It'd be a really fun time. They actually also had Shushu on an album of theirs. So going through the network.
And in your musical career, have you ever been approached by a label or given any kind of what anybody has presented as an opportunity or anything that was actually an opportunity? This whole fantasy of getting signed, has that ever been on the radar?
I got one that was completely not up my alley. They basically wanted to have me do stuff that I didn't want to do, essentially, like make like some kind of alt rock band or some kind of like industrial band, which I was like not really interested in. I'm not much of an industrial musician. I don't have much expertise in that, and also it's just not my comfort. It's not my comfort. If a label's going to sign me, I would prefer to make the things I want to make, and have people like me just because of that. But yeah, that was one of the only times I think. That a label has reached out to me. I forget what they're called. And then, of course, there's Fake Four Inc., where Chesky's just extremely supportive of like my vision and what I want from my music and what I want to do. So that's the other one that I actually would like to partake in.
And what do they do, Fake Four? I mean, I'm just asking, like, in terms of like, what do we think of as of a indie label as actually doing these days? Like, what is this relationship like?
So I'd say they have a lot of connections within like music video work and distribution work, like merchandise, vinyl sales, cassette tapes, you know, funding certain projects, stuff like that, and getting better better publicity than I ever could.
Good. So they do manage that.
Yeah,
because I always wonder whether, you know, about labels and whether they're actually doing anything. Because it used to be
Fake Four is a bit, I think it's one of the bigger indie labels out there. It's got a lot of really amazing rap and alternative music on it. One of my favorite Native American bands is a rap group called, what is it called? I'm terrible with names of bands. So if you look up Native Drunk on Spotify, I can't remember. If you look up Native Drunk on Spotify, you'll find an illustrated mess. That's the band. There we go. That's right. One of my favorites. But they host that band, actually. And that is, it's really clean, really great studio work. They also, I think, they know Ty's Studios, so I would get a better sound from my stuff, a richer sound than I can with, you know, just my makeshift DIY setup at home.
And when you're imagining touring in the country and in the U.S., I just wonder what a tour like that looks like in terms of how are you traveling and where are you staying? I'm just I wonder if you have that all those little details in your mind.
Yeah, it's a rough journey, especially when I'm not like super well known. But like, I have toured not playing music, but toured with other bands as they did their thing. Mm-hmm. And that was a lot of fun, even though I wasn't playing and whatnot. But I'd imagine it a lot like being homeless with a car for a little while. And I'm okay with that, I think. I think that would be fun, you know, go back to the roots and play some music at places. Yeah.
And you have, there's been the role of crowdfunding in the arts has been basically very, very dominant for your entire adult life, as relatively short as it's been so far, I guess. And what it's like basically growing up with that phenomenon being everywhere, and how do you relate to that, and how what's been your experience?
Such a strange thing. I was raised on a lot of 80s stuff. So I grew up thinking, for instance, that the music label, or not music label, music industry wasn't going to collapse anytime soon, or wasn't already collapsed. I also believed that CDs were really big, and that cassette tapes were really big, and vinyls were really big. I grew up playing
a time bubble or something.
Yeah, exactly. I grew up in leftover kind of stuff from either trash dumpsters or the local free store in my town. I got an NES, Nintendo Entertainment System, and I played that quite a lot, and it blew my mind when I finally got an Xbox. I didn't realize that there were three dimensions video games, and that was like there the entire time. I just didn't see it. I grew up watching like old orange colored Nickelodeon VHS tapes, and I watched a lot of old movies like, what is that old Neverending Story?
I love that movie.
Yeah, I was actually my dead name, my birth name was based off of that movie.
Right.
So
I turned my daughter onto that movie when she was young, and I think we watched it for like 5 minutes before she was just so bored with the complete lack of special effects, and I had never realized, it just never occurred to me it was all just puppets. I loved it as a kid, you know, but yeah. Then I realized, oh yeah, okay, it's not fast moving.
I still love that movie. It's still such a good movie.
Well. Yeah. I think we can conclude the public segment of our conversation. There's been a lot of people commenting on various platforms and enjoying it. And you definitely need to, we both need to meet Mustard Toast in Lisbon. I love that name, Mustard Toast. I don't know if he likes.
Yeah, I think they're in my stream sometimes.
Oh, good. There's also a band called Beans on Toast in England.
Oh, I love Beans on Toast. They're great. Oh, a little bit neoliberal for me, but I still love a lot of their songs. Price of Rice is rising or whatever.
Well, everybody, I hope you've enjoyed this conversation with Jane Reynolds, Virtual Bird. Look for Jane online.
Thanks.
You'll find amazing music. Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks to everybody who tuned in today.
Yeah, really, and you can find this broadcast. Look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be up in a few hours in podcast form, and and otherwise the video is up on home. Wherever you're watching it, it's there, and it'll be there. All right. Talk to you guys. If you're tune in tomorrow at 10 a.m., I'll be hosting Fifth Estate Live, talking with longtime organizer Karen Pickett about her lengthy arrest record and we're going to be actually talking. It's an overview of the sort of the history of Earth First, and it'll be a fascinating conversation tomorrow. And remember, mutual aid will get us through. Don't pay your rent unless you really have to. Trust your neighbors. Bye for now.